Good morning, everyone, and while we're waiting for this to load up, we're going to be doing a little change of pace from what we've heard before, and we'll be talking about a cost of disparities methodology that we said was for state health departments, because that's where we developed it. And we said that because we wanted people not to think it was something that was so intimidatingly complex that you'd have to have a university professorship to be able to understand it or do it. It's certainly not something you couldn't do in a local health department, but we just didn't have enough room in the title for all of that. And I would like to acknowledge Dr. Carlisa Hussein, who's here in the audience, our office director, who assisted me with the preparation of this presentation. And as far as funding support goes, since it was a project of the health department, I guess we could say it's funded by the taxpayers of the state of Maryland. And the mandatory disclosure slide, there are no personal financial relationships with commercial interests that I have to disclose for this presentation. So now that we've satisfied the lawyers, the topic of the conference is public health without borders. And we thought that the place that health disparities fit into a borders concept is that they actually represent borders within a nation's borders. And so it creates artificial borders between health and unhealth that might be drawn along lines of race and ethnicity, or along immigration history and status, around geography, whether that's county and jurisdiction, or whether it's urban versus rural distinctions, gender identity, sexual orientation issues, various determinants of socioeconomic status, or potentially other group identifiers. Now, Maryland turns out to have a 41% minority population, and 30% of that population of ours is, of our entire population, is African American. And that actually ranks us about fifth in the nation in terms of percent of population that's racial and ethnic minority. And that is the focus primarily of our office. And when we look at some of the disparities that we see in Maryland, they're not that different from what we see nationally. So we see in terms of mortality disparities that compared to white mortality rates, African Americans have 26% higher heart disease, 12% higher cancer mortality, 26% higher stroke mortality, diabetes mortality 2 times higher, influenza and pneumonia 10% higher. HIV and AIDS 13 times higher mortality rates, kidney disease 2 times higher, homicide 7 times higher, and infant mortality rates 3 times higher. And if we look at some of the other indicators that we have, and these now come from our behavior risk factor surveillance system surveys, prevalence of diagnosed diabetes about 2 times higher for African Americans and about 50% higher for Hispanics. Prevalence of diagnosed hypertension about 30% higher for African Americans in the middle adult age groups and about 17% higher for African Americans in the older age groups. We also did an analysis of end-stage renal disease data and found that we have 3 to 6 times higher incidence, in other words, new cases of end-stage renal disease, depending on what age group you're looking at, for both our American Indian and African American adult populations, and about 20 to 30% higher for the Hispanic adults. Like in the U.S., we noticed higher rates of tuberculosis and hepatitis B in our Asian populations, and rates of uninsurance are higher for all of our minority populations. So clearly we have this problem. Where are we going to find the resources to eliminate health disparities? And one of the things we think about in asking that question is, well, someone's going to save money if we do this. So those who are going to save the money from the elimination of health disparities ought to be the ones who invest the dollars to get it done. It just makes sense. So who is that? Well, that's the insurance community, that's the employer community, and it's government, because government is both an insurer and an employer. So the question now is, how are we going to convince these entities that it's worth their while to invest some money in eliminating health disparities? So we have to make the business case. So what is the business case? What do we have to answer for them? And they have two basic questions. First one is, why should they care economically? We hope that they care humanitarianly. But economically, we've got to make a justification. So we have to convince them that the benefits of elimination are worth the cost. And there's 3 steps to that. We have to estimate the cost of disparities, and that's what we're going to talk about in this presentation. Also, we have to figure out how to estimate the cost of elimination, which may be more complicated. And then we need to try to demonstrate that the cost of action is actually less than the cost of inaction. The second thing we have to do in this business case, which we're not really going to cover today, is once we convince them that it's a good idea, what are they supposed to do? So we have to back that up, a series of evidence-based interventions they can select from to utilize once we're convincing them that they need to act. But that's a different presentation. So there's a fundamental dichotomy in the way I like to think about the etiology of health disparities. So if we think about disparities in morbidity, mortality, and healthcare utilization, think of them as arising from either disparities in the disease frequency between the populations, higher incidence or prevalence of disease, or a disparity in what we call treatment success, or you could call it management success, among the people who have the disease, or a combination of both of those things contributing to the disparity that you see. We want to be able to estimate those costs separately between what's the disease frequency component and what's the treatment success component, because some of the stakeholders may only think they can address one or the other of those pieces. And we think that simplicity is often a very elegant thing to have, and simple methods have advantages of easy replication by others and ease of understanding by target audiences, because frequently in a state health department we're talking to audiences that aren't highly trained in epidemiology and data, so sometimes the simpler the message, the better. Our approach to this cost of admission disparity methodology is to first estimate the percent of minority admissions that are excess, then determine the number and cost of minority hospital admissions. That's the outcome we're going to use in this example. And that allows us then to estimate the excess number and cost. So the first step is estimating the percent excess. And back in 2004, our asthma department was writing up their report, and they came and asked me what they might include in their report about disparities. And I said, well, maybe you can put some disparity ratios up for different elements like prevalence and utilization and mortality. And so they built this wonderful table. And where this comes from is prevalence data out of the BRFSS database. And from our utilization databases on emergency visits and hospitalizations, these are asthma-related emergency visits and hospitalizations, and these represent the ratios between African-Americans and whites, and then this from our vital statistics is the mortality ratio. So you see about 20% higher prevalence in African-American adults, but that generates 3.7 times the emergency visits for asthma, 2.6 times the hospitalizations for asthma, and 2.8 times the mortality from asthma. And remember this 2.6 number, because we'll be using that in some formulas in just a moment. And just so you know that that's not some kind of unusual number, this is based on some pooled numbers from about 99 to 2003. In the subsequent year, they looked at 2004 data and got essentially the same pattern in their next report. So it's not just one odd year or a couple odd years that came up. And this kind of just summarizes the fact that with 20% more cases, but we get 270% more emergency visits, 160% more hospitalizations, 180% higher mortality, where we'd only expect 20% more if the treatment success were equal between these two groups. So we have a huge disparity in treatment success. And so what do I mean when I use that phrase, treatment success? And that encompasses all the factors that might influence what happens to someone with asthma as to whether they stay out of the emergency room in the hospital or not. And that includes their susceptibility to triggers, their exposure to triggers, what's the overall burden of triggers in their environment, and all triggers like stress as well. What's their access to care? If they can get to care, what's the quality of the care that they get in terms of the treatment planning that gets done? Do they come out of there with the right instructions? And what's the disparity in the empowerment of patients to be able to take care of themselves at home with that treatment plan? Because we believe that the medical care of chronic disease doesn't really happen at the doctor's office. It happens in the patient's home. And unless we empower and equip the patient to do the plan at home, we've wasted all the effort in the doctor's office. So all those things are part of that large thing we think of as treatment success in this framework. So the way we're going to take those numbers from that table and get a percent excess is to go back to introductory epidemiology and pull out that concept of the attributable fraction in the exposed. And that's a number that answers the question, what fraction of an outcome in the exposed population is due to the exposure? And it's got a formula where we take the risk that we find in the exposed group and we subtract out the risk in the unexposed group, and that's our numerator. And that gives us basically the excess risk, or what's often referred to as the attributable risk. And now to make this attributable fraction, we divide it by the total risk in the exposed. And that gives us the fraction of the total experience in the exposed that's due to their exposure. So that this is restated here, excess risk due to exposure divided by the total risk in the exposed. Now, some of you may remember this in its alternate form, which is the relative risk minus 1 divided by the relative risk, and that's just taking this upper formula, dividing each term by the risk in the unexposed, where these two things become relative risk and this becomes 1. In this example, we're considering exposure to be African-American and unexposed to be white. So now if we look at what's the disparity in these admissions attributable to both the disparity in frequency of asthma and the disparity of treatment success. We'll assume the white admission rate is X. The black risk minus the white risk divided by the black risk becomes 2.6x minus 1x divided by 2.6x, and that comes out to be 61.5%. So 61.5% of black asthma hospitalizations are excess due to this disparity in both of these components. And if you plug in the RR minus 1 formula, it comes out to be the same thing. Now suppose we want to estimate the disparity in the treatment success alone. Then we say again, assume the white admission rate is X. To ignore the frequency disparity, we would say if they're we would expect the African Americans to have a 1.2x because based on, you know, if we say the treatment disparity was there, but we're not going to worry about that, we'd expect, not having taken care of that, for the African American rate to be 1.2 times higher. So that now becomes our expected black risk. So we now have 2.6 minus 1.2 divided by the 2.6, and that comes out to be 53.8%. So here we've got 53.8% of black asthma hospitalizations are excess due just to the disparity in treatment success. Or to summarize these two findings, overall 61.5% of admissions are excess, 53.8% is treatment success disparity, and 7.7% is disparity in asthma disease frequency. So now we've got a couple percentage numbers, and we're going to take these and move through to figure out what's our excess cost and number of admissions. So we go to our Maryland Hospital Discharge Database. We're going to find all the admissions with an ICD-9 code for asthma as the primary diagnosis. But the next question is, does that get you all of the asthma admissions? So you have to understand that ICD-9 is primarily a billing and reimbursement device, not a medical record device. So a lot of times the codes are used to justify the costs and the procedures, not to necessarily express the medical record accurately. And therefore, an asthma patient that ends up in the ICU may very well have a respiratory failure primary diagnosis to justify the ICU visit, the intubation, et cetera, and asthma as a secondary diagnosis. So to do this, we looked first at just the Medicaid admissions, because that's of interest to the state in particular. So we picked the race of the patients to be black, the payer to be Medicaid, primary diagnosis to be asthma. That was 492 admissions for a $2.2 million cost, $4,500 per admission. If we multiply by our two different rates, we get treatment success, 264 excess admissions for $1.2 million. The overall disparity, 302 admissions for $1.4 million. We add in our respiratory failure primary diagnosis group and then look at any secondary diagnosis being asthma. That's an additional 62 admissions for another $1.4 million and now $23,000 per admission, so five times the cost, much higher intensity of illness. And again, our 58% from treatment success, 33 admissions for about $800 million, and the overall 38 admissions for about $700,000 and $900,000 for the overall disparity from both causes. So again, just kind of putting a chart out here, you can break this up into primary, secondary, all asthma admissions, disease frequency, treatment success. You can see what the numbers are. 2.3 million overall, with 2 million of that just from the treatment success piece. So we said, well, let's look at this for all payers. And let me go through this rather quickly without going through each of the details of this slide. We'll go to the summary slide. And here, overall, we had $17.5 million of cost to all payers from asthma admission excess, and of that, $15.5 million coming from the treatment success disparity. So we see this as a method you can use to look at trying to get a handle on the cost to the system of these disparities, and we think, of course, like everything else, there are limitations. And although we think simplicity is an advantage, simplicity does have some limitations to it as well. We have a lack of specificity, because you'll see here we used an all-payer percent excess that we calculated from the overall numbers, but we plug that into some payer-specific calculations, and maybe that's really not the disparity within that provider population, so that's maybe a little bit of an imprecision there. Also, we're stuck with all the limitations we have in our original data. So if race and ethnicity is misclassified or missing, you don't know whether you've got the accurate picture of what the rates are in the individual groups or what the ratios are, and then you calculate the percent excess, and all those errors just carry through. And then you've got misclassification issues in the prevalence data in BRFSS potentially. Did people answer the questions right about where they did and didn't have disease? Are the ICD-9 codes really reflective of what really happened, or is there some trouble there? So we always have to take a little bit of this with realizing there's imprecision. And we can always run into problems with insufficient data for small subgroups. So when we come up against that problem, we can sometimes pool multiple years of data together, which can help us to get some better precision if we're looking at smaller groups. And sometimes age adjustment in 10-year age categories can actually be a limiting factor because you don't get enough size in the cells to really do that. But sometimes if you coarsen up the age adjustment and make that maybe a larger group, because sometimes we'll age adjust in like 25 to 44 and 45 to 64 and 65 and older, you still take care of the vast majority of the age confounding that's in there, but you still get numbers in the cells that allow you to get it done. So that can be a technique that gets you forward beyond that limitation. Some of the strengths, we do think that simplicity does have some strengths, and we think this is a method that's relatively easy to perform and easy to explain to people. And the nice thing is you can actually do this without being the person who's the holder of the original data. If you can get somebody who's got the original data to give you some of these pertinent numbers, what's the admission, the prevalence rate in this group and that group, what's the admission rate in this group and that group, what's the total dollars we spent on admissions for this or that diagnosis, you might get that as a request from some of your data people, and then you can plug it into the formulas and produce the estimates of the cost. And if we think about the cost in terms of scientific notation, A times 10 to the B, if we're talking about $2 million, it's 2 times 10 to the 6th. And whether the 2 is 1 or 3 is maybe not so important. What maybe really matters is it's 10 to the 6th. It's millions of dollars. It's tens of millions of dollars. It's hundreds of millions of dollars. Whether it's one or two of those isn't so important. So I think we're probably getting B right with this method at least, and maybe that's what really matters here. And we think it is refinable and generalizable. You can add more complex specificity by going into some of these payer-specific numbers and say, well, let's isolate, if we can, the prevalence information from a particular payer and start to remove some of those non-specificity issues that come up. And you can generalize this out to emergency visits and to other types of utilization as well. So we've just taken the slice of hospital costs, and this is just the hospital component of the hospital cost, not even the physician component of the hospital cost in there. So we did some additional calculations since we wrote the abstract up in terms of what kind of costs are we seeing in some other places. For diabetes, we saw the excess, and this is now combining the frequency of disease and treatment success issues together. Medicaid spent an extra $3 million on diabetes admission disparities. The system, in terms of all payers, spent an additional $26 million. And for all diseases, Maryland Medicaid, $59 million, and all Maryland payers, $481 million. And for the all-disease group, I would say that that's certainly an underestimate because this number is being somewhat washed out by the fact that there are disparities in the other direction that we know about. For example, African Americans have joint replacement surgery less at a lower rate than our white population, even though their rates of arthritis are equal and their rates of arthritis-related disability are higher. So with clearly similar or greater need, they get less of this restorative surgery. And these kind of beneficial procedures, as opposed to procedures that are examples of catastrophic care, if you will, are going to dilute out some of the true cost excesses that we see on the catastrophic care side. So I think when we look at numbers that are approaching $500 million in costs, that our concluding thought would be, it's not that we can't afford to address health disparities, it's that we can't afford not to address health disparities. And with that, we'll show the contact information, and I'll wrap it up.
Thank you, Dr. Mann. We have time for questions and answers. So if you have questions, what I'd like to have you do is if you could state your name and then your affiliation. That would be very very helpful in having your colleagues know who you are and where you're from. So, does anybody have any questions? We heard a lot of information today. Okay.
Mike Lozier, Riverside County, Department of Public Health, the local health department. Aha. If you look at the 2005 local health department expenditures, we're all going to have the bioterrorism money that increased our numbers, and our infant mortality probably didn't change, so is that going to look like we're going the wrong direction based on the statistics? And the categorical grant funding versus local health dollars, if you don't differentiate those, I think it's a challenge because the grant funding is becoming a bigger and bigger percentage of the department's budget, the categorical funding.
Yeah,
you have to repeat that question to the microphone.
Did everybody hear the question?
Yeah, did everybody hear the question?
Okay. I think that...
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's good. Yeah, Betty wants to respond to that question as well, and I think that one of the... you may have noticed that when we did our presentations, you know, we are using historical data from 1990 through 1997, and you may be asking yourselves, like, why did they do that? You know that's so long ago. And we did that very consciously for some good reasons. And one was we wanted to, first of all, we actually did want to sort of avoid the 911 phenomenon of a lot of influx of dollars going into local health departments that may or may not be related, you know, those dollars may or may not be related to services that may be affecting mortality. So we decided to stick with the profile data, you know, in terms of where we could get the profile data on the expenditures. So, you know, that was one reason why we stuck with sort of a steady state, you know, 1990. There's other reasons why we stuck with 1990 is that for 1990, you essentially have data for all of your variables, expenditures, local health department expenditures, other factors that influence health from the 1990 census, just everything that you need. You have baseline variables for everything in 1990 to the extent they exist. The other phenomenon that's going on is that in 1990 is when Healthy People 2000 came out. And so 1990 is sort of a benchmark where, you know, the local health departments, state health departments, the federal public health system was beginning to think about not only improving population health, but also reducing health disparities. There were benchmarks that were set in place. So to some extent, 1990 is just an important policy benchmark through Healthy People 2000. So that's some reasons. And maybe Betty can contribute more answers to that.
Well, the first part of the study that Dave really focused on was the expenditure piece. And so we tried to avoid that phenomenon, the big, massive influx of preparedness money by doing that. The other piece in terms of looking at the impact of all the preparedness activity as a programmatic activity is another question. The early profile surveys don't really have much data around that as a service or as a programmatic activity. So in terms of doing a time series analysis in the upcoming study I'm doing, or the one I'm working on right now, I can look at what it says now or in the 2005 profile about that, but I can't really compare it to previously. And also, we do have some ability to look at the extent to which health departments get money from grants versus other sources. But I think we looked at that a little bit in the in this other study, but it really didn't tell us a whole lot. And, you know, we're limited by the data as well. It's really hard to sort of tease out where these funds, if we have grant funding or suggest grant funding, where that grant funding is going to. But it's an interesting question that it hasn't escaped us, but it's been sort of hard to figure out how to tie it in.
My name is Carnisa Hussain, and I'm working with Dr. Mann, so of course I don't have a question for him. I have a comment and question for the others, and I find your work fascinating. I think it's really interesting that we got some baseline during that period, so that is great. I'm hoping that that can be replicated so we can have some comparison. And the things that are going on in the nation are confounding, but that they are also highly affecting what's going on in terms of health. couple of thoughts. Again, going back to both limitation slides, a couple of ideas that you might keep in mind for the future is that racial congruency is a real important issue in looking at services and service outcomes in health departments. And certainly the IOM report and many reports since then point that out. It's another issue that we talked about here is, are the determinants of health. And we now know that we need to begin to look outside of health, outside of public health, and the so-called population-based approach, that we have to be more focused on the specific groups in the population. And as you proved so well, we don't know what's impacting them, but the interventions that bring about positive effects appear to be quite different in black or African-American populations than the others. So we need to keep driving to find what those are. And there are suggestions that themes such as racial congruity, cultural competence, and I know that word gets overused, but we need to keep it on the table. And also the whole issue of measuring stress and its racism based on, stress based on racism that's been institutionalized in African-American populations, mm-hmm. and that we're now beginning to pick up and pull out, particularly when we look at the example of minority infant mortality, and we're looking very closely at why that's happening when all the other factors seem to have been balanced out. In Maryland, we are very concerned about that, and Dr. Mann and I in particular are trying to look at how we can impact minority infant mortality in a particular region, so we're trying to use some different strategies. But just some thoughts on this. This whole area is so exciting. I don't know what others think about it, but we need to keep driving down this road because we're using too much money in this country not to have better results for all of our populations.
Yep.
Question in the back first.
I have a general question about the profile survey. Has there been a demonstrated relationship between mortality rates in general and local health department expenditures?
Did you hear the question?
Paper and Betty's paper were funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Healthcare Changes in HICPO program, and their in terms of their public health systems initiative. Glenn Mays, are you here? Glenn's over here. Glenn and his colleague, is it Diane Smith?
Charlotte.
Charlotte Smith wrote a paper looking at the relationships between local health department spending per capita and changes in mortality in the general population, and has found positive effects in the sense that per capita increases in local health department spending are related to reductions in mortality.
Could you cite that reference again?
His Glenn, maybe you can speak to this, but your paper, your results have been documented are under review at this time.
Yes, they're actually in press now at the Journal of Health Services. We're talking a little bit about that study and session on Wednesday morning.
Okay.
Just a brief question about the costs. Very good study. I scratched my head trying to understand. It's very complicated. But if I understand right, the average cost per capita went from 28 to 44, which is like a $16 increase over 50%. And I assume that's inflation adjusted.
It is.
And then the percent of available revenue went from 1.3 to 1.8%. So did you do a cost analysis to see what those actual cost increases were spent in? Are you able to describe that? I know that relates to you, but obviously these were substantial increases in spending. I'm just wondering if you were able to pinpoint what the actual
order was. The answer to your question is no. We would have loved to have done that, but the limitations with the profile data sets are severe. And basically, you know, this is there's this number there in terms of per capita expenditures which you can calculate, but they don't you can't drill down to get at what you're asking. Most importantly, you know, there isn't any information in this data set or in the profile data sets explaining why some departments increase in per capita, you know, their expenditures and why some health departments decrease. And those causes may be just as important as looking at the relationship, you know, between expenditures and mortality or disparities in mortality themselves. You know, we don't know that. And I'd love to have that information. It would really inform these analyses.
And I mean, we could say the correlations that we did between the expenditures and some certain of the services at least tell us what are the more expensive services that people are providing, you know, and have some consistency over time with those. So we can at least pinpoint that, and there were really no surprises there. But to really say how they were in fact spending that money, those data just weren't there.
Well, that's the $64,000 or $64 trillion question, depending on what era you're talking about, I think. I can't say that I have an answer to what would it cost to eliminate disparities. But I think that from our perspective, we get involved in issues where the legislature is considering whether they should put $1 million into infant mortality or not, or $500,000 into adult health disparities, or various proposals that come up. And as they're struggling with their various budget decisions, and in times like this that gets even tighter and more heated, I think if we're going to have a chance for them to even consider putting something like that or leaving something like that in the budget, we have to be able to say, well, you know, this thing that we're trying to attack with this money is costing you this much money. Because if we can't say that there's going to be no chance it's going to stay in the budget. So I can't yet tell you that I've got all three of those components I talked about answered, but I think we got to be able to start to make the put the cost on the table so we at least get their attention. And while I would agree with Sir Mamet's talk about wishing we didn't have to talk about the business case, and you'd wish the humanitarian case would be enough, I think the reality is that it hasn't been enough yet, and we have to drive the humanitarian argument, but inform it with the fiscal argument, I think, to really try to make the progress we need to make.
I think we have time probably for one more question, and then if we have enough time. Okay, go ahead.
Just
a brief comment?
A brief comment. We had legislators that talked about the business case, actually on October 1, a major summit in the state. And the issue became the upfront cost sometimes can be a distraction from it. We have to be careful about that. Because that belies the fact that there are some current costs right now that have a negative impact. So when you start to think about trying to identify those and pull those out, that can cover the so-called upfront costs. So, but we need to learn a more, it's a good question, we need to learn more about it, and we shouldn't be fearful of that full upfront cost because it's a negative to the, it's a positive to the inappropriate costs that we know are in the system.
Thank you. Okay.
My question is for the second speaker. I understood you right, you said, among other things, that increased breadth of services in community disease screening and treatment was associated with an improved infant mortality rate among blacks, and an increased breadth of services in maternal child health was associated with an improved white infant mortality rate. Do you have some theory
Well, that's a good question. It was sort of the hopeful sign for us that some of what we do really makes a difference. And I'd like to think a lot of these other things, or we can hope that a lot of these other things do, but they just take a longer period of time. I do have some theories that around maternal child health. Why does that impact white infant mortality and not black infant mortality? I'm really not sure about the CD was it CD control? The CD control piece, unless that that could have a lot to do with. I don't know, it'd be interesting to hear people's ideas. The maternal child health piece, I think, well, that's been sort of the bread and butter of a lot of public health departments for a long, long time. And it's nice to see that if that's one of our more expensive things, it's actually doing some good, at least in reducing mortality, infant mortality among white people. But why is it not impacting blacks? One of my little pet theories, among others, is that it sort of could speak a little bit to the nature of our workforce. And we're largely, the majority of us sort of designing and implementing these programs are white people. And so the extent to which we can have an impact, we are more likely perhaps to be able to have an impact and design what works best for other white people. But there are many other, I can't prove that. I'm also going to be looking in a study now on looking at the nature of the workforce in local health departments and changes in the workforce over time. And although there's not a lot of data around racial and ethnic groups within our workforce and those data sets that I can use. But that's just one small piece. I mean, there's a lot of other factors here, and I think that we are not touching on in terms of or impacting appropriately or adequately or effectively in some of these other populations. The CD control piece, I don't know. Does anybody have a interesting suggestion as to what's going on there? Des?
Hey, didn't you say that you ran 100 different models?
108.
And if you run 108 models and you ask enough questions, aren't you going to come up with some positive associations for some of them?
Well, that's another thing you bring up that I didn't really go into, that there's this whole notion of endogeneity. There may be some other factors in there that are sort of creating some two-way causation and that kind of thing that are muddling this up. And there was some evidence of some of that. And so there is more I have to do. And I wouldn't sort of take away all of these findings as the be-all, end-all. There's a lot more that we have to do. The takeaways to me are that what we do, our services do not appear to impact populations similarly. And we may really need to target our interventions in different ways and sort of think outside the box for different types of populations.
Brief comment, and then we're going to be out of time for today.
Okay. One of the things that I wanted to actually piggyback on response to Betty's comment, as well as the comment about the expenditures, we don't know how these health departments spent their money. That's one important omission. I would also love to know in the profile survey data set, to what extent was the health department actually trying to reduce disparities? You know, to what extent were services and planning directed at improving population health versus reducing disparities? To what extent was that an actual goal, and to what extent were services actually targeted at reducing the gap? And, I've been following a lot of the movement in Europe in terms of reducing, the population health goals in many European countries. And many of those countries who are more at the top of the ladder in terms of longer life expectancy, particularly than the United States, are now putting their dollars and efforts into reducing disparities across various social groups. And there's clear evidence that that's where the work is going. I have no information from the profile survey about to what extent these health departments are actually trying to reduce disparities. So that's another information gap.
Thank you. unfortunately, we're out of time for today. I want to thank you all for coming, and please thank our panelists.
Thank you very much for your comments.
Yeah, you folks are doing
it. Oh, really?
There's so much to be done. So much to be done.
Yeah, thanks. Good to hear about your paper.
I did a study a few years back.
Do you all have the work that you're doing on this up on that website? Where
oh, yeah, it's up. We have a copy with us. And I was going to just raise a question about the diversity in the workforce.
That's Betty's
yeah.
project.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
But I think that's real important issue.
Yeah. She's working. She has a some other additional funding to look at that.
Yeah, we have federal funding too to look at that. Working with all of the health professional schools in the state on that issue. How much did it cost to do that? I meant to ask.
Our grant was for about $150,000. And most of it was personnel.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
How long? Over what? A year? 2 years?
Yeah, we had, it was a 12-month study.
Okay.
And then we extended at 6 months to do additional analysis.
Fantastic. Thank you.
This is great stuff.
And we still have to finish up a little bit more on Betty's piece.
Right.
Yeah. So we'll keep watching your website and whatnot, but this is fascinating.
Thank you.
Right.
Yeah. I'm presenting on Wednesday morning at our last day.
Oh, absolutely. Right.
I can give you my card. Is, yeah, that'd be great.
And I'm really excited to talk to you. It's quite fascinating to finally hear someone talk to you. It's very trying to get people on board or trying to get folks to be
here.
I think it's an important I think it's a really good way of getting stakeholders who may not necessarily be inclined to want to address
the method generalized.